Wisconsin. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network. It is 3 o'clock, and that means it is time for Maggie and the Millionaires Talking Money. Now, my next guest, she is not herself a millionaire, but in honor of Labor Day, this week, Maggie and the Millionaires are going to be talking and focusing on being overworked and underpaid. The fact that we all, us middle-class folks, work very hard for our money in America, and we're maybe not quite getting ahead as we should. My guest is Dr. Caitlin Henderson. She has let me know that I can call her Katie, so I don't mean to take your degrees away. Dr. Caitlin Henderson, she's a senior researcher at Oxfam, which is the largest anti-poverty organization in the world. Dr. Henderson is the lead researcher and author of Oxfam's Best States to Work Index, which Brian and I will put in the show blurb from today so that you can all check it out, which looks at how states treat workers and working families in the U.S. Previously, Dr. Henderson was a Brent Scowcroft Award Fellow with the Aspen Strategy Group. So with all of that, welcome, Katie. Thanks so much for making time.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm thrilled to be here.
This is so important. But before we jump in specifically to how Wisconsin is doing compared to other states, tell us about what the Best States to Work Index is, and how long have you been doing this report, and how does the index work? Like, what are the inputs? How do you rate these things?
Definitely. So our Best States to Work Index is a piece of research that looks at 27 different policies across three major themes, and those are wages, worker protections, and rights to organize. And we track these 27 policies across all 50 states, DC, and Puerto Rico, and we rank the states on how they perform, with the idea being we're really encouraging a race to the top of the index. And the index was really born in a moment when the federal government wasn't doing much to improve worker policies and help out low-wage workers and working families. So the idea was really, while the federal government isn't doing enough, let's take a look at what states are doing to really step into that gap. So we rank all the states on whether those policies do or don't exist, in order to really celebrate where progress is happening and try and encourage where progress can be made.
So why did you focus on these three categories? Again, just to refresh everybody's recollections, you're looking at wages, worker protections, and basically whether or not the right to organize in a labor union is protected under state law. How are you measuring those things? Why did you focus on those three items?
Definitely. Great question. So we've been doing this index for about 6 years, and the research really started when we did a huge scoping exercise of what are the policies that are most necessary and most important for workers in general, but especially those low-wage workers that maybe are not receiving benefits from their employer. So a lot of folks that have great jobs have great things like good wages and paid leave and all kinds of protections at work. And so what happens when workers are not guaranteed those from their employer? What happens when they rely on the state or the federal government to set that standard? So that's how we kind of created the list of the policies and really thinking, you know, what is the most important thing for workers? And there are some very obvious answers, like a minimum wage. Right. And you know, I think we all recognize the importance of paid leave, especially in this post-COVID moment, when having the ability to take a sick day was so critical. But also there's a lot of great information on the union difference. And so we really wanted to look as well at how states were supporting unionization, but not just unionization, also, you know, collectively bargaining for public sectors, and and really trying to get a holistic picture of what is most important for that low-wage worker and their families.
I know that you added a new category or specifically called out warehouse workers in this year's most recent report, which I found fascinating. Immediately my head went to, oh my gosh, of course we're talking about Amazon, right? And frankly, some of their now notorious, what I would call union busting tactics that they have deployed. And it also raised for me, I want to kind of ask you about this as one big, very broad category. I understand as a lawyer and someone that both was in a collectively bargained unit and then entered management and had unionized workers working with me. My understanding has been that the National Labor Relations Board has been effectively like defanged sort of in the post-Reagan era, right? And that their ability to really penalize companies like Amazon for union busting has been quite neutered, and they don't have as much power as they did, which speaks to the very need for the index in the first place and for states to step in. So all of that is a really big open-ended question for you, talking about warehouse workers.
Yeah, so let me take one quick step back just to say, sure. the really cool thing about this index is that it is a dynamic living piece of research. So we are able to add policies every year when we see sort of a changing landscape for workers. And one of those changing landscapes that we're really seeing is the increased use of technology in workplaces. And I think warehouses are one of the best examples of that, where mm-hmm. we're hearing a lot more about the use of technology, not just to surveil workers and keep tabs on them, but to institute quota systems to mandate production. What's hard is that a lot of these quota systems are really unobtainable, and they're causing a huge influx, or increase rather, of injury in the workplace. And so one of the reasons that we included the warehouse worker protection policy to the index this year is we're seeing some states really pay attention to that and create new policies that are really setting the standard, not just for other states, but also for the federal government, of what can be done to support workers in what is a very dynamic and changing landscape for workers as we're moving into these new sort of hybrid environments where it's both technology and people supposed to be doing the work. So that's one of the nice things about this research, is that it can respond to a changing world. And then to your question about what does this mean and what are we seeing when it comes to the National Labor Relations Board? You know, for folks who are unfamiliar, that is the entity that sort of oversees the ability for unions to form. When you want to create a new union, that's who you register with. It is a federal government entity. And you're right that there has been a weakening of the National Labor Relations Board for the last many years. It means it's harder to form a union. It's harder to sustain a union. And that's actually just looking at the federal level, right? And this piece of research, when we're zooming into the state level, we see for sure that, you know, National Labor Relations Board aside, where you have those right to work laws, it makes it even harder to get even the first step, which is to make a union. And what we're talking about here is, you know, the repercussions of if you're trying to stymie unionization is so important, but that's even step two, especially in those states that have the right to work law on the books.
So two questions, and I don't want to forget either of them. The first one was, I was wondering, Dr. Henderson, if you could describe how truly incredibly onerous some of these warehouse worker quotas are. I have seen some of the reporting on this, and I could not believe what was being asked of human beings. It was just, the quotas were basically, as you noted, unmeetable. And the mental stress as well, which then also contributes to more on-the-job injury. Can you give folks an idea that they might be able to understand how huge these quotas are that people are being asked to meet in Amazon warehouses?
Yeah, and you know, we're seeing, I think a lot of people reference Amazon as the big instigator of this. And I think that more than just Amazon warehouses are starting to use this policy, which is why we need to really think about it. But we have some great partners that are doing sort of the leading research on this. So I cannot take credit on the information that we do have about these types of quotas and the impact, but it's effectively the idea that you have to be on your feet for essentially 7-8 hours at a time at breakneck speeds, reaching and pivoting and moving and trying to fulfill tens to hundreds of boxes full of things. And it's a rate that is just not tenable. And it means that people are constantly injuring themselves, whether it is throwing their back out or being physically injured from a machine. You know, it's just really increasingly more and more dangerous. And it's so important to pay attention to, because we are very reliant on warehouses now to fulfill even our most basic needs. So many people completely shop online. And so we need to really pay attention.
Yeah, every box you get, somebody had to pick that product off a shelf and get it in the box. And again, the speeds that I've seen and some of the firsthand accounts of workers have just been shocking, in my opinion. Listen, my special guest this half hour for this Labor Day week, honoring workers in America, for Maggie and the Millionaires Talking Money. She is not a millionaire, but her name is Dr. Caitlin Henderson, senior researcher at Oxfam. We got to take a little bit of a short step away to take care of some of our business, but we'll be right back with Dr. Katie, because I want to talk about these right to work laws, and then I want to find out, how's America doing? How's Wisconsin doing? Because I have a little sneaking suspicion that we ain't doing so well, because we've got one of those right to work laws as well as Act 10. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network. We'll be back with more for Maggie and the Millionaires with Dr. Caitlin Henderson, senior researcher at Oxfam, the largest anti-poverty organization in the world.
Stumble to the kitchen, pour myself a cup of ambition, and yawn and stretch and try to come to life. Jump in the shower and the blood starts pumping. Out on the streets, the traffic starts jumping with folks like me on the job from 9 to 5. Working 9 to 5, what a way to make a living, barely getting by.
Welcome back, Wisconsin. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network. You are in the 3 o'clock hour, so it is time for Maggie and the Millionaires Talking Money. My special guest this afternoon is Dr. Caitlin Henderson, a senior researcher at Oxfam, the largest anti-poverty organization in the world. She and Oxfam have just released their report for this year called the Best States to Work Index, which looks at how states treat workers and working families across the U.S. Before the break, Katie, we were talking about right-to-work laws, which I always think is a really interesting name for these pieces of legislation, because everybody's like, well, right to work. Yes, that sounds good. I support everybody's got a right to work. But what does this legislation actually do? It should basically be called the anti-union bill instead of the right-to-work bill. It'd be great if you could explain.
Yeah, absolutely. So a right to work law is effectively a law that makes it harder to form and maintain unions. It sort of takes the teeth out of unions a little bit. It takes money away. It means that you no longer can require dues from your members. It makes it harder to unionize. It makes it harder to collectively bargain together. And it means that a lot of the benefits of unionization is pulled out from under them a little bit. It makes it a little bit, just a little bit weaker to be part of a collective unit when you're going to the bargaining table and trying to negotiate for things like benefits or salaries or working hours or pensions or whatever the case may be.
Yeah, just some of the specifics for folks at home. If you've heard this, what it means is that each year, any existing union has to effectively recertify. In other words, the membership has to say, yes, we want to continue to have a union, and people have the option to opt out and not have any of their wages go to union dues. All of that sounds really interesting and maybe a little appealing, except that, of course, what you have the sort of inertia element of this, because it requires an affirmative action by workers every single year. We all are suffer from inertia. We generally will tend to take fewer actions when all else is equal, so it's less likely workers do that. And also, you then run into a fundamental collective action problem. All workers benefit from the union bargaining, but if you're opting out, you're effectively shirking or free riding on the union benefits that your union provides to all workers for the most part. We could get into some specifics on that, but just wanted to let people get a little bit of a baseline there. So let's jump in. How is America doing overall for working people and working families?
Frankly, it really depends on where you live. Mm. One of the big reasons we did this index is because the federal or national standards are so low, and some states are doing so much to make things better that now there's widening inequality totally based on the geography of where you live. And that can include neighboring states, which is really complicated. In this country, where you live shouldn't mean whether or not you get paid a fair wage or whether you're protected at work. But increasingly, that is the situation because there hasn't been movement at the federal level. I think Wisconsin is actually a really good example because Wisconsin neighbors two states that have much higher wages in Illinois and Minnesota. In both Illinois and Minnesota, there's paid leave. So you have the ability to have a paid sick day, not lose a paycheck if your child is sick. And in both Minnesota and Illinois, there's some stronger protections around the right to organize. So you can live 5 miles from the border of a different state and yet be paid significantly less and have significantly fewer protections. So as a country, we are really waiting for the federal government to step in and create a higher standard. But if you're living in Oregon or California, Washington State, DC, you're doing a lot better than some of your neighbors, which is honestly not super fair.
It's not super fair. It also, in Wisconsin, we hear from many of our business owners, Wisconsin's a great manufacturing hub of the United States. Businesses love to come here because our workers are skilled. We traditionally and reputationally work really hard and are incredibly productive. And yet you set up this sort of inequity and it will lead to brain drain or just worker drain. People will leave because they're not going to get the same level of wage and benefits as they would in some of our neighboring states. How is Wisconsin specifically doing on this best states to work index relative to some of our neighboring states and overall?
Yeah, so Wisconsin is ranked at 38 out of 52. So again, this is all 50 states, DC and Puerto Rico, if you're wondering where that 52 is coming from. So Wisconsin's in the lower half. And one of the big reasons for that is because a lot of Wisconsin's laws in regards to workers are reliant on the federal standard. Wisconsin has a minimum wage of $7.25, which is the federal standard. Wisconsin has no paid leave. Wisconsin doesn't extend many protections to workers that we consider federally excluded, like domestic workers. And Wisconsin is one of those right-to-work states that doesn't have many protections for unionization. I will say, and credit where credit is due, because I think it's important to identify where progress is needed, but celebrate where there is positive policies. Wisconsin steps up in a lot of ways for farm workers. And I think that's important to identify. Wisconsin is a great state when it comes to agriculture and farm working. And so there is some positive policies there. So we do see the potential for great policy change in Wisconsin, but there's still room to improve. You know, compared to some neighbors, Illinois is at number 7, Minnesota is at number 11. So it's wow. quite a difference. Yeah.
What is, we just have about 2 minutes left. What is the one or two policies that you think can really have the biggest impact for working people in the U.S.?
I think for all working people in the U.S. and Wisconsin as well, let's raise the wage. Let's raise the minimum wage. Let's get rid of the sub-minimum tipped wage, which yes. traps too many, especially women, in cyclical poverty. Let's get some paid leave so people who have care responsibilities in their communities can miss a day of work to care for someone but not lose a paycheck. And let's really protect the right to organize. We know the union difference. It increases wages. It increases protection at work. You are safer. You're less likely to be injured. You have more benefits. It does matter. So if I was going to say three things, it is raise the wage, pass some paid leave, and let's protect the right to organize.
Folks, that's Dr. Caitlin Henderson, senior research at Oxfam, the largest anti-poverty organization in the world. They just published Oxfam's annual Best States to Work Index. Folks, Brian and I will put that in the blurb for today's show so you can check it out with your own eyes, but you heard it here. Raise the minimum wage, paid leave, which is a big old fat duh, right? And protect workers' rights to organize. Thank you so much for making time for us, Katie. I can't wait to have you back again. Stay tuned. The Maggie Dawn Show continues here on the Civic Media Network after these three messages.
Yeah.